Hey everyone, welcome to the very first episode of Fish in the Year 2024. This is going to be a really big year for us. We're incredibly excited. It's our 10-year anniversary. 10 years of Fish this March. That's over 500 episodes, 29,000 facts. Well, actually, so far, 29,597 facts, to be exact. We know that because Andy keeps a spreadsheet. So thanks to everyone who's been tuning in all this time. I hope you had a great holiday break. Hope you had a great New Year's. We got a great episode for you today. James is away on holiday at the moment. So in his place, we have another James, a Reese James. I'm sure you're all aware of Reese James. He's an amazing stand-up comedian. He's appeared on multiple TV shows and radio shows. Most predominantly, I would say, as a regular on Mock the Week, where for years he was a panelist. And actually, if you go to Reese's Instagram account, which is at Reese Jamesy, so that's Reese James, but with a Y at the end, you'll find the funniest Instagram account out there, in my personal opinion. It's the reason I basically stayed on Instagram for a long time. He's uploaded all of his single one-liners that he's delivered on the show Mock the Week from over the years. And honestly, you will be in tears laughing. So get that into your life, follow him there. And if you want more long-form stuff by him, you can go to his YouTube account where you'll find an entire radio show that's been uploaded there. And that's called Research, as in Reese's name, but mixed with research. Research. And to describe that show the best way would be to say it's answering all of life's big questions, but done in a sort of brass eye mold. It's incredibly funny, and you must check it out. But in the meantime, don't go anywhere, because you can enjoy him here on No Such Thing as a Fish. So here we go, on with the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of No Such Thing as a Fish, a weekly podcast coming to you from the QI offices in Holborn. My name is Dan Schreiber. I am sitting here with Anna Tyshinsky, Andrew Hunter-Murray, and Reese James. And once again, we have gathered around the microphones with our four favorite facts from the last 7 days. And in no particular order, here we go. Starting with fact number one, and that is Reese.
Soap is the best way to move a building. How do we feel about that?
That was so dramatically presented. Yeah. I really enjoyed it.
I actually racked my brow. I had other options of ways to introduce that headline. I went with that basic, really simple one. Mm. But I was going to say something like, washing, removing stains, moving buildings. Just three of the hats soap wears. that's what I was going to go with. But it's the first fact, you know, keep it simple. I had that in the locker.
No, absolutely. I think you played it right, though.
Yeah.
So what's the story here, then?
So in Nova Scotia, at last, it felt very local news, this story. And there was like a local news video about it. But basically, an old Victorian building that was mostly used as a hotel for about 100 years. It was going to get knocked down. Then a company bought it because they wanted to attach it to a planned apartment block, sort of 30 feet away. And instead of moving it the traditional way with rollers, they used 700 bars of ivory soap because that's the softest soap and therefore the slippiest. And they did that successfully to then get it onto new foundations. And then once that is complete, they are going to move the whole thing back.
Why?
That's the end. I don't know. Okay. They're going to move because basically it's like a protected landmark, this old building, I think.
Yeah.
And so they were going to restore the whole thing and put it back to where it was, which to me just suggests you wanted to move it with soap. Yeah. You didn't need
but
to move this.
Yeah, if it's protected, but we've also proved beyond doubt that it's mobile.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter where it is as long as we're protecting it.
Take it on the road.
I found it amazing how little soap you need to move. I mean, I looked at a photo. This is a big building. Yeah. 700 bars of soap is obviously lots of bars of soap. But it's not that many.
Surface area-wise, it doesn't feel like
They didn't even use 700 bars.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they took some home, didn't they? Yeah. I think some of the builders took... There was 20 to 40 bars left. So they used most of it.
They estimated
quite well.
Yeah. No, but I mean...
At last. My God, you don't hear that a lot.
Well, the crazy thing is, this is not the first time that soap's been used to move buildings, but it's clearly an essential ingredient as part of the process of what they're doing. And it was as they were getting ready to move it that they went, we don't have any soap. So it's not even like they've bought it in industrial bulk amounts. What ended up happening was the guy who was in charge of it, his wife Leanne, had to run to 15 shops around the area and buy, using 970 something bucks, the equivalent of 700
It suddenly, when you put it like that, it suddenly sounds quite Taskmaster, doesn't it? It's like, there's like a panic there of like, oh my God.
And he, wasn't this guy, Sheldon Rushton, the lead builder guy, said, I think he said at first he thought, I'll just ask my wife if we can use some of our soap from home. And it was only when she said, we're absolutely not doing that, I'm not giving up our personal supply, that she offered to drive around. Which made me think, how many bars of soap are you stockpiling in your house?
Exactly.
But also, how precious are you about whether soap is your personal supply or not? Sorry, surely if it was like, yeah, you can use some of our old soap, but use some of the budget to get us some new soap. Surely the same thing.
You're right. Has she written diary entries on the
wrapping? Yeah, it's got sentimental value, her own personal soap.
I think once you're mixing work with pleasure, it's sort of...
I agree with that. And it's... We're not actually sponsored by Ivory Soap this week, but... It is very, very soft, apparently, and that's great. So,
and if you do use the offer code FISH, you are going to get 20% off.
You'll get nothing. You get absolutely nothing. You get a weird look. But the basic method you use to move the building is, you dig under the building, don't you? And then you put steel beams under the building. Then you lift the whole thing up by 1 inch on hydraulic jacks. Just jack it up 1 inch, and you slide the soap underneath it on trays. Mm-hmm. And then I think you lower an inch and it just kind of squishes the soap, but it's incredibly soapy now.
Yeah. So you leave it overnight to squish the soap, right? You sit it on the soap overnight, which I feel like a building's heavy enough that you only need to sit it on the soap for 10 minutes.
No, these guys are experts, Anna.
They know what they're doing.
Yeah. And then what? You're trying to create a sort of slip and slide aspect to it.
Yeah.
I bet they can just push it, and it's just about the weight you push it, where it like curling.
Yeah.
And then it just does it land in the bit you want the building to be in eventually. I'm like, no, I pushed it too hard, it's gone in the sea.
It's a thousand of them with brooms trying to slow it up.
Have any of you curled?
Never.
No. I've curled. Oh, I curl. Sorry, but I curl.
I
was trained by the British Olympic curling duo for the Winter Olympics just gone.
Yeah.
Clang.
Oh, big time. Whose names are, and then just insert them if you want. they were lovely.
And, why were you hoping to be the third member of the team?
Yeah, I did a thing for Team GB's like YouTube thing. I went and had to do 4 Winter Olympic sports because in the Summer Olympic podcast, I had said as a joke that I reckon I could master any Olympic sport in a day.
Right.
And I was just, I was being hyperbolic. And then suddenly their next series, they said, go on then. And I mastered none of them in several days. One of them is curling, though, which was the easiest, but it's like insane at first because also they're not very technical with their language. So they literally just call it grippy shoe and slippy shoe. And you have one of each.
Oh, that's like bowling.
Right, you get a grippy
and a slippy. Yeah, yeah.
So you have, they gave me like this thing that goes under your shin as you slide along at first. It's basically like a little ice skate, but it just rests. But I think you just have that at first and then you're supposed to just slide on your actual shin.
Yeah.
But at first, they give you that at first. That's like barriers in bowling, I reckon.
Right,
or like the thing that you push the ball down to make it.
I see. How did you do?
Pretty badly, I think. But it was better than when I had to do speed skating and smashed open my chin on the last shot of the whole thing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah, that was much worse.
Wow. Good ending, though.
You a little ski for the bottom of your chin. Like your knee curling.
Yeah, that's what I needed. Yeah.
Reese has come in today dressed fully in skis, by the way. Head to toe, skis for every limb.
Well, the only issue with the idea with this building being the curling system is you could probably get it into place with one big push, but then you might have a rival building behind you knock you out using the same system.
You know, the Titanic was put on soap. I think we've said before that the Titanic was put on soap to go down the slipway.
Whale blubber and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, it was tallow and oil and soap, and it was 20 tons of it that was used, which I find amazing. But obviously,
that's more than 700 bars, isn't it?
Yeah. But I did. So I was just reading a bit more about that. I'd never read this before. That workers, they would go to the slipway afterwards and try and gather up any spare soap that was left over.
Oh, to use themselves.
Interesting. Yeah.
But it was also covered in sort of oil and
you could probably wash it, right? You could probably wash away that, and then you've got the soap sitting underneath.
I guess so.
I don't think soap gets, because you can just wash off the upper layer.
Oh, there is a big debate online about whether you can get soap dirty.
Welcome to the show. This is the kind of controversy we try to avoid.
Well, of course you can. Of course you can. I'm willing to weigh in on this debate.
Please.
Of course you can get soap. Me too. Hey, Matt, of course you can get soap dirty.
I believe, of course you can get soap dirty, but it doesn't stop it cleaning you. So it doesn't matter.
Interesting.
If your soap's dirty, doesn't make a difference.
The level of dirty it would have to be for the dirt on it to make you dirtier.
Yeah.
And outweigh the cleanliness of the soap being applied to you. It's so dirty.
Yeah.
But you're at that point, right off that bar of soap.
Sometimes in horrible pubs, there will be a bar of soap at the sinks. and you look at it and you think, oh, I'm not sure.
Well, this is a thing. There was a report that was done, a sort of a research project to look into how clean actually are in bathrooms like pubs and stuff. How clean is the soap that you're getting? And they've worked out that some of the dispensers are left for so long where they're not maintained and they get cracks in it that you can go to the toilet, wash your hands with the soap and leave with dirtier hands than you arrived with. Yeah, because they found 15 types of bacteria that were sitting these dispensers that would make it onto your hand as part of the soap. And they would stick.
Same pull handles in the toilet. You think, I know what people are doing in here.
I know.
I'm gonna make a call on this toilet thing and say it doesn't make your hands dirtier than after you wash them. Because it doesn't matter if there's bacteria on the soup dispenser. So on the soup dispenser, it does matter.
Well,
don't eat the soup. But on the soap dispenser, isn't the point of soap that it gets onto your hands and then it makes the water and the dirt on your hands more slippery and so gets them off, and it doesn't matter if there's bacteria on the dispenser.
Yes, it does. It does.
The soap immediately gets all of that off, so which is why it doesn't matter if a bar of soap is dirty.
No, but that's the amazing thing about soap, and that's why it's so incredible that we, you know, as a species discovered it millennia ago. It not only makes the dirt and stuff on your hands slippery to slide off, but it also has this structure which tears open bacteria and viruses. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Like it's okay. I want to read this because I don't want to get it wrong. Each molecule of soap has a head which bonds with water, and then a tail which hates water. Right. So and sort of is hydrophobic, you know, and tries to avoid it at all costs.
That's horrible identity crisis.
I know.
This poor molecule.
And the tail seeks oils and fats and things. And basically, bacteria and viruses, they're surrounded by a lipid membrane, a fatty membrane, and when they touch soap, the soap kind of envelops it, and also the soap molecule tails, which are trying to avoid water, realize there is a fatty layer on that bacterium and burrow into it. They sort of wedge themselves in, and that rips the bacterium apart. So that's the other thing that's going on, as well as making things slippier.
Yeah.
It's just amazing.
Mm. It's really clever.
That's incredible, yeah. And it smells nice.
And
lest we forget.
Naturally.
That was the main comment of the builders after they moved that building.
And it smells nice.
Honestly, they said they went away smelling great.
Yeah.
Do you know, though, what is better out of, and I feel like I've presented this in a really obvious way now, out of antibacterial soap and just a bar of soap?
Antibacterial.
Dan, you idiot. I mean, I even said it, so the answer was clear. No, there's a serious worry that people are converting to antibacterial soap a lot and hand soap. And there's a guy called Professor Lithgow who works at Monash University in Australia. And he says that he thinks they should all be banned, antimicrobial soaps, because they're not better than just a bar of soap, even though we've got them all over our house now as a COVID hangover. Not better than a bar of soap. Hand soaps where you don't use water are significantly less good because, you know, when you get a hand sanitizer, because the water doesn't, you need the water to scrub away and wash off that layer. Mm. And he says that they're causing a huge amount of antibiotic resistance because we're shoving this antibacterial soap at our hands, and all the bacteria is becoming kind of super bugs on our hands.
Yes.
And he explains,
they're adapting.
Exactly. We're all going to have just these super bugs living on us. So really, and this really surprised me, it's not about the antimicrobial chemical properties really as much as it is about the scrub. But actually, the key is, as long as you scrub your hands really hard with the water, it scrapes them off.
And with the soap.
And with the soap.
Water
yes.
does all right, but soap is the thing that really...
But there's definitely something psychological about the smell and presentation, though, right? Of how clean you feel, because natural soaps don't feel... They obviously are better, and you could make soap out of just oil and lard, basically, can't you?
Yeah, yeah. But,
you know, if I'm rubbing oil on my body, I don't feel... And lard.
Mm. Bit slimy,
massively
isn't it?
Clean.
No.
Even though you're saying it's like that, and the scrub of that is what actually makes you clean.
Why am I getting so turned on I need about the finish, though?
Well, I shouldn't be rubbing myself, but... but you need the... it has to have a scent, or I won't feel...
Does it?
Well, also, I've not used a bar of soap for years, and I find a bar of soap disgusting.
Haven't you? I've only used
never
bars.
Never a bar. Come on.
I don't mind a bar of soap.
Are you a cartoon? Are you all cartoons?
I don't use... In our house, we have the... Yeah, we have liquid soap as opposed to a bar of soap. Well, I would use it.
A little pump.
A shower gel type situation. You're looking at me like I've never heard of pump soap. I am familiar with the concept. But you should just feel very guilty because, of course, you are single-handedly destroying the world.
No palm
with all
oil.
Of your
always
plastic
say
use.
No palm oil, please. What is the issue? Plastic.
Forgot about that. Yeah, plastic. Is it wrapped?
Wait, who are you saying? paying it to? Your soap, your personal soap.
I say no palm oil, please. to my butler. Sorry, did I not make that clear?
Is most soaps I have, again, I actually haven't bought a bar in ages, aren't they covered in quite a plasticky kind of wrapping?
Yes, Dan. Paper. But
is it paper these days?
There is a spectrum. We've seen is a spectrum is here. From Anna, who uses only old-fashioned bars of soap that have to be cut from the mother block wrapped in greaseproof paper. Up to Dan, who has like those auto dispensers at every doorway in his house. So the other this is such a boring thing to say, but actually if you use bar soap, it's got a slightly lower carbon footprint in the travel emissions.
Yeah, cool.
Because you're not, you know, with liquid soap, you're mostly transporting the water.
Yeah, but what about, but what about the satisfaction of a foam burst? You ever used a foam burst? I became briefly obsessed with foam bursts.
What is a foam burst?
It's just a soap that is literally designed to become extra foamy when you're lathering. And so, you feel it's exciting. It's very exciting way to start or end your day.
Just feels like you're not engaging with the ethical issues here, really. Listen, you're very much scent and foam based. Listen,
and I'm happy with this girl record. I couldn't give a fuck about the ethical issues here. I flew here.
Okay, it is time for fact number two, and that is Andy.
My fact is that the 19th century author Thomas Hardy had two funerals at the same time.
Did you say 19th century author so we didn't confuse him with the 21st century actor? Because he's still alive.
Yeah.
This is Thomas Hardy, who wrote, I'm confusing it already, Jude the Obscure, Tess of the D'Urbervilles, Mayor of Casterbridge.
We don't need the full bibliography.
About 900 poems. Mm-hmm. He was a big deal.
He was.
He was mega famous, actually. And that was sort of what led to this problem. Basically, he was meant to be buried in Dorset, in his native Stinsford, with his first wife, right? And it was all ready to go. There was a space on the tombstone for him, his name to be added, you know. And then he died. And then his friends, including James Barry of
Peter
Pan fame, and Sidney Cockerell, who slightly less well-treated by history, but, you know, I'm sure a big deal at the time. They went to his home basically on his death and they said, we think he should be buried in Poets' Corner in Westminster Abbey. He's a huge, huge deal. And they kind of bullied Thomas Hardy's second wife, Florence, into going along with it. You know,
right.
She sort of said, well, okay, fine. So they struck a deal whereby he went to Poets' Corner and his heart went to Stinsford. And they both had a funeral at 2 p.m. on the 16th of January, 1928. And that was the...
I mean, real Sophie's choice for his second wife. Sorry, you're either going to be buried in Poets' Corner, which is not where you're supposed to be, or with your other wife, your previous wife. And, oh, no, we'll just take your heart to your previous wife.
I know, it's really...
You might be, where the fuck do I come in all of this? Are you taking
where am I ending up?
Yeah.
It's true. And also, like, well, I think reading into it more, I think his family was there as well. So that was kind of...
Stinsford. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. No, not in Poets' Corner. And so because his first wife, they didn't particularly get on too well, like deep into the marriage. To begin with, they did. But there was a lot of...
It was a
painful marriage, according to a lot of the friends and close relatives and so on.
And herself. And him, himself.
So why is he... Why did he want to be there?
Well, the family, I guess. She just happened to be there.
Right.
He felt huge regret about what a dick he was to her, it was said. He treated her quite bad. She kept a book. My God, it's the greatest title I've ever heard.
Yeah, he found after she died, and they did have this difficult relationship, didn't they? And she's a very interesting, weird character. But he found in the attic after she died a diary that she'd written, basically called something like "What I Think of My Husband," and just loads of bitching about him. And he did, and he'd feel so awful, and he felt really guilty reading that. And I think he burned it.
Immediately,
so we don't know
I feel so bad. Okay, let's just pop that in the fire.
Burned it on the gaslight.
I think that's every husband's nightmare. Titled that. Oh my God,
it's not a dream for every wife, I'm going to tell you.
You're not picking up a book called "What I Think of My Husband" and expecting positive review, are you? He's great. End of book.
Oh, dear.
Always helps. He always listens.
And she lived in the attic. She just moved into the attic after a while after their relationship started to go really wrong. Oh. She was the sane woman in the attic.
Well, I mean, sources differ on the sanity levels.
Right.
And then he remarried. He married Florence, who was 39 years his junior. There's a big difference there.
The list of not even guests at the funeral of Thomas Hardy, but the pallbearers. You had, just before mentioned, James Barry. J.M. Barry was one of the pallbearers. You had George Bernard Shaw. You had the Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin, as one of the pallbearers. And then, you know, various other names that were obviously massive.
Two prime ministers being pallbearers, but one of them wasn't Prime Minister yet.
That's right, leader of the opposition at the time.
Ramsay MacDonald, who was then the first Labour Prime Minister.
Yeah.
Rudyard Kipling.
And Kipling, yeah.
Also a pallbearer. I mean,
I guess, is this that surprising? Like, if Richard Osman dies, I wouldn't be massively surprised if, like, Sebastian Foulkes, Ian McEwan.
Yeah, but this is the equivalent of Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer also turning up.
I don't think you get a lot of volunteers to carry that coffin. He's a big lad.
Oh yeah, your poor burial list would be very long, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I wonder
how tall Thomas Hardy was, because he had 10.
Did he?
Which feels like a lot.
Normally
you can fit 6.
Oh
yeah,
okay.
Good point.
You know,
very squeezed in.
I know.
I think he was definitely quite puny as a baby. And his mother gave birth and they went, oh, well, we'll set that side because it's not alive and we'll retrieve the mother. And they put him to one side thinking that he wasn't alive. And then the midwife, who probably wasn't doing a job particularly well, said after a few minutes, oh, hang on a second, this baby's alive. We should keep it going.
Good grief.
And he was and for the first few weeks, everyone assumed that he would die. And he was quite a weakling, I think, when he was younger.
Mm. Are you guys any fans of his stuff?
I read Tess of the D'Urbervilles at school.
Did you know?
And it was the first, as it were, literature book that I'd read. Up until then, I was reading spin-off Indiana Jones novelizations, and it blew my mind. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he wrote my favorite poem, The Darkling Thrush. Amazing poem. Yeah. If you want to read it.
Well, he considered himself a poet more than an author, didn't he? Despite these like seminal.
He was much more successful as an author, right? That's just like
He was extremely successful as a poet as well. And the last 30 years of his life, he only wrote poetry, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, he had success, but this, to me, is like Ant and Dec considering themselves musicians. Like they've been successful in the charts, but you wouldn't say the famous...
Yeah.
Yes.
He had a repertoire.
Yeah, musicians Ant and Dec have died is not what's going to be...
Exactly. Yeah. But he just, this to me is just like, you know, his Twitter bio would just be one of those ones that's just like a list. Poet, author, son, father, husband twice.
For anyone who's listening who's not a fan, basically the books are, they're amazing, but they're also incredibly gloomy. As in, they feature all sorts of, you know, terribly unhappy people, making poor decisions and getting on badly with each other.
I think he has a reputation. Far From the Madding Crowd is not a gloomy book. Everyone always says such sad books, but yeah, don't read Jude the Obscure if you.
Jude the Obscure, The Guardian a few years ago, they produced this fantastic infographic on what each book contains in terms of, you know, various traumas. Right, so. Jude the Obscure was by a long shot the winner, but it features, they just listed like in little bullet points what it features. An unhappy relationship, a death, another unhappy relationship, another unhappy relationship, grinding poverty, suicide, murder. That's one child who kills two others and then himself. Miscarriage, alcoholism, another death, and animal genitalia-related injury, which I had forgotten about, but which does feature in Jude the Obscure.
Does it? What happens?
Which bit is that?
Jude, he meets his wife Arabella when she throws a pig's pizzle. A pig's penis at him, and it wallops him on the bonds.
When you said animal related genital injury, I would never have guessed that. I was going to something biting.
Yeah,
something.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But I never would have thought it was the animal's genital that was in that
doing
was
the injury.
Doing the causing
You're
the
right.
injury
yeah.
to a different part of his body.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Dismembered pig dick was not what I saw coming.
On my bingo card for 1894.
I got the train in today to King's Cross, and I had a bit of time on my hands, and I went to see something pretty incredible.
The tree?
I went to see the Hardy Tree.
What's that?
The Hardy Tree is old St. Pancras Church, which is just up the road from St. Pancras Station International. And it's a church where you have a graveyard there. And when Hardy, prior to becoming a full-time writer, I think maybe he was dabbling in writing at that point, but he was an architect beforehand. And he used to work in London. And he worked for a company which was called Blomfield. And one of the things that Blomfield needed to do was they needed to move a lot of the graves that were in the area to make room for a new rail track. It was the mainland, Midland Grand Railway. And so they had to exhume bodies. And it was something like thousands of bodies that they had to exhume. And they had all these leftover tombstones. And Hardy did this thing where there's about 100 of them, of these tombstones. They are all sort of layered in towards the tree. It's so hard to describe.
Well, like they like circle the tree.
Is the tree, because the tree fell down this year.
The tree fell down in 2022.
Yeah. Oh, has it fallen? I saw it years ago. But it was like when it was like the roots were like growing over the tombstones. Yeah. Oh. It's almost like give the illusion that the tombstones were sinking because like roots were starting to grow over the top and they were getting shorter and shorter.
Yeah. So
but
storm,
I didn't know it fell down. So what is it?
A storm took it out, but they've left. There's a big fence around it at the moment. They're working out what to do and which way to restore it. But yeah, that is literally a bit of art slash architecture by Thomas Hardy. As you say, you saw it when it's full place. And God, just generally, by the way, what an extraordinary cemetery that is with such notable people. Mary Wollstonecraft is buried there, who was the mother of Mary Shelley. And there's this story, which all academics think is almost definitely true. It's one of those ones where it's like, there might be a tiny grain of untruth. It's where she used to go and sit and read her mother's books against the tombstone. And it's where her and Percy Shelley first had sex on the tombstone.
That's literally the kind of thing they would have done.
Yeah. But so,
Goths, man.
I think that's fair.
I highly recommend it, though.
Of course you would, Dan. You recommend all sorts of stuff.
I mean, going to visit the cemetery.
Dan's sex advice podcast is going to go down like a lead balloon.
But also, incidentally, one of the people who were buried underneath, supposedly, all those tombstones is the writer who wrote the vampire who was part of that weekend with Mary Shelley.
Polidori.
Yeah, Polidori. Yeah.
Can I shatter your illusions, though, about that lovely concentric circle gravestones and tree?
Okay.
Tree has nothing to do with him.
What?
Yeah. Everyone calls it the Hardy tree. There's no evidence it was planted in his life, when he was an architect. There's no evidence it was, they think it was planted about 50 years after he died. It only started being referenced in the
70s. He just made the circles, randomly.
I thought.
All we know, I'm pretty sure, is that he was indeed employed because he was low down in the architect's firm. So the architect said, could you dig up all these bodies? So he did dig up the bodies.
Yeah.
And he, in fact, he remembered later in his life when they were digging up the bodies, opening one grave that had two heads and one body. And that was a fun memory for him. And he said some of them were just skeletons loose in the ground. Some of them like crumpled apart.
He was digging
apart.
Them up personally.
He was there overseeing it and other people under him were digging them up.
Two heads, one body.
Yeah. We don't know he made the stone circle. Ooh, we just know he dug up
the
body.
It sounds like he just littered some gravestones somewhere. The story is losing a lot of its impact.
A tree grew and turned them into a perfect circle. It's like genuinely like a natural phenomenon.
Some poor person, probably a woman, came afterwards and said, hey, it would look nice if we did this. And then everyone's gone. Oh, it was Thomas Hardy did it.
That's classic Tom. Yeah.
Interesting.
Can I give you guys a quiz?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Okay, so we all know Thomas Hardy, and we all know about Kiss Me Hardy.
Yeah.
And we all know about Tom Hardy, the actor.
Yeah.
Right? So which Tom Hardy, I've renamed these headlines, all so they all say Tom Hardy, so that's not a clue, okay. Right? Which Tom Hardy are these about?
Yeah.
Okay. Goldfish removed from Tom Hardy pond to protect newts. Which Hardy is that about?
The actor.
Author.
Author. You're both right. Sorry, Dan.
Well, it's a bit loose calling him Tom.
I've changed the headlines so they all say Tom Hardy. So that's not to avoid being a clue.
I see.
Because people
only
say Thomas or Tom.
Yeah.
Tom Hardy fuels James Bond rumours.
Author.
Well, no, let's see it. Let's go back to when the first James Bond was written. Let's do the dates align.
Fleming was a pallbearer at the author's funeral, so I'm locking that in.
Okay.
Author.
No, I'm so sorry, Dan. That's about the actor Tom Hardy.
Damn it.
Last one. Tom Hardy wins jiu-jitsu contest in Milton Keynes.
I don't think it's any of them. That's just a different bloke.
No, it's the actor. Last year, he just turned up in Milton Keynes at the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu Open Championship held at a school in Milton Keynes. And kicked everyone's ass. He won. He was champion in his
held
section.
At school, but it was adults. It was to turn up and go, well, this should be a walk in the park.
Absolutely went through year eight like a dose of salts. No, he has a blue belt in jiu-jitsu and just destroyed everyone. Like, because it's quite intimidating if you turn up and see Tom Hardy, you know, Bane, Mad Max.
Yeah. Are you allowed to just wander in? Surely you have to have entered in advance.
He did enter in advance. He registered.
Oh, he registered.
He just registered like a normal person, you know. And I bet someone
who works at that school who was organising the whole thing read it and went, It won't be that Tom Hardy.
Yeah, yeah.
He walks in like, yeah. Fuck. Yeah.
Hell. It'll be the author. Absolutely terrifying.
Do you know, I just want to bring up the second wife very quickly, Florence Dugdale. So that was her name. She was an author herself, published author. There was, as you say, huge age gap. Apparently they got on really well, though, according to friends who also said that the first wife and Thomas didn't get on. She wrote a biography of him. And he didn't burn it. It was called The Early Life.
Is that because he died?
No, it's because it turns out he actually wrote it mostly himself.
Oh, no.
And it was published under her name. So,
oh my God.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing you do if your first wife released a book saying, yeah. You're a piece of shit. You suddenly go, how can I protect my reputation here?
Isn't that astonishing? Yeah.
That's really, and has that survived?
Yeah.
Because a lot of stuff didn't. A lot of stuff was burned. A lot of his correspondence was burned almost immediately after his death, which has really vexed a lot of biographers, obviously. Because,
yeah, right.
So much burning of books went on back in the day, didn't it? Like, they were constantly burning books. So he burned most of his own diaries, I think, as well as burning his wife's diaries.
Yep.
She burned, his second wife burned the courtship letters between him and his first. Or I think maybe his first. Everyone was burning letters and books left, right, and centre. Why don't we do this anymore?
I do. I do. I've set fire to so many laptops. It's a nightmare.
All of your wife's diaries immediately go in the fire.
There you were criticising my carbon footprint. Burning every book he's ever read. Pallbearers, obviously celeb pallbearers, very cool.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's a modern version of it, mm-hmm. I'd say, of like having lots of, well, not famous people being pallbearers, but like something cool to do, which is Tupac. You know this about Tupac? Mm-hmm. If Tupac's dead, then Tupac's gang members smoked his ashes.
Oh.
No way. Wow.
Yeah, as was requested in a Tupac lyric. He said in the lyric, "When I die, smoke my ashes," basically, in slightly different words that I won't use.
Yeah. But,
I've got a question.
Yeah.
How can you smoke them if they're already ashes?
Well, exactly.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't made of tobacco.
Well, I did say smoke his remains, but I'm doubting there's like an arm.
You
need a very big briar pipe to get an arm into, wouldn't you?
Yeah. No, it was ashes. I don't know. I guess they just...
You just maybe shove it in
poetic. Might mix it in with some tobacco.
Yeah.
Delicious. And other things,
I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it was tobacco.
Okay, it is time for fact number three, and that is my fact. My fact this week is that the UK literally have fashion police. Quite literally. So
speaks a guy who's just been arrested for that choice of hoodie.
So it turns out that one of the things, there's a lot of things that happen within police work with forensics, and a very important bit of it is trying to identify when a body might, you know, if you find a body, how long has it been there, diagnosing all that stuff. And one of the things that might help you with that is the clothing that the person is wearing. And so there's this fashion historian called Amber Bashar, and she basically goes around, and she worked for Beyond Retro, and she was a fashion historian. She liked to find where products were coming from, at what point they were using certain materials and so on. And there was a police forensic investigator who saw what she was doing after hearing her on a Radio 4 show and thought, I wonder if that's going to be interesting for me in terms of trying to diagnose how old a body is or just give us a bit more detail. So that's what she does. She goes around for the UK police. She'll go to a murder scene and she'll look at the exact fabric that they're wearing. And obviously, as we know, like, you know, if you were going to die today, you might be wearing old clothes from...
I was going to say, are me and Andy going to look like we're from the 50s because we just have never bought new clothes for ourselves?
Exactly. Yeah, that's the issue, right? But I suppose it just plays into a bigger picture of what they're doing.
Absolutely.
So there's one story which is a bit upsetting, but an old lady passed away and they found a body that was wrapped up in a bra, and she was able to look at the bra and work out exactly when the bra was from to be able to say, so it must have been this year that the body was in there. And she does it, by the way, there's a lot of amazing archives of clothing, and one big one is M&S have a massive archive of clothing that she can look through and find the history of items, because a lot of Brits are going to be, you know, dying in M&S clothing. Sorry.
I hope to one day. I don't mind when the day comes, as long as I'm in my trusty M&S.
That's what people say, isn't it? Yeah, it's like people often, you know, how they want to die, they often say in my sleep or in my M&S cagoule. Either's fine with me.
Yeah, and we should add that this is also not a sponsor that we're doing right now.
I reckon there's certain items of clothing where I could tell you when that person died.
Oh, yeah.
Buried in a Von Dutch cap. I'm going 2001. Straight away. Livestrong band. Come on. You get in a 5-year period.
Yeah, okay.
What about the cycles of fashion, though, every 30 years? It could always it either be around. Like, you know, it was last year or 31
so
years
it has
ago.
To be, so, yeah, so it has to be something that hasn't yet come back.
Okay.
Yes. So, you know,
right.
Oh, yeah. It's not retro. It's like white guy dead in a Wu-Tang 36 chambers top.
Sure.
97, 98.
Yeah. Exactly.
So well, I've always worn flares at some times. Well, that exactly, would have confused right? the hell out of police. At other times, it's perfectly acceptable. I don't know what phase we're at now. Are we in a flares phase?
Yeah, we are actually.
We are.
Oh, there we go.
Often she just goes, well, what we have here is a time traveler.
Yeah.
I recruited a bit of help by this. I wrote to an expert. Val McDermid, the author, aka Queen of Crime.
Holy shit, that's a clang. Jeez. We thought the old curling team was a clang earlier.
Unnamed curling team.
I know her very slightly, and I just asked her about this kind of stuff. She's written a book, as well as all her novels, she's written a book about forensics. And she said that natural fabrics decay when you're buried. As in buried in the woods, you know, that kind of thing, if you've been killed. But labels are usually man-made fibers, so they survive, right? So they can provide a clue if it's foreign label or a designer label or whatever. So she says, if you're planning a murder, go for mass-produced cotton and snip those labels when it comes to dressing your corpse.
Oh. Good to know.
That's very helpful.
All right.
Thank you, Val.
Yeah.
That's good because you can tell how big the person was, even if the whole body's disintegrated, right? You can still be like, size 8. Size 14.
This does feel like, this story feels most like, you know, Netflix are on the phone buying the rights to this series, surely, of like the person who solves crimes based on
labels
you're wearing.
Yeah. Sorry, I thought you meant buying the rights to this podcast, which so far.
They are available.
And she's cool. Amber, if you see a photo of her, she dresses like she's like someone from Beyond Retro Wood, right? Like she's got like old school clothing. She looks like she could be in a sort of Agatha Christie.
Should she be a vintage detective? What could we call it?
What, the series?
Yeah, series called...
Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Yes.
Dressed to Kill.
Brilliant.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
All
right, we've got two films.
Have you heard about this thing of the principle of interchange or the principle of transference? So one of the fathers of forensics was a Frenchman called Edmond Locard in Lyon, and his basic theory is that any two objects interacting will leave a trace. So when you commit a crime, you will leave something behind that wasn't there before, like a bullet in a person, and you will take away something that was there originally, right? So that's the founding principles. Like all you have to do is work hard to find those.
What's the thing? You'll take away like a bit of dust or something. It's not
exactly,
like you'll always...
Yeah, or a fibre on your shirt.
Not a souvenir.
Always cut off a finger.
But this, now we are so good that sometimes makes things difficult for forensics people. So for example, if I hug Reese and then I am murdered, Reese will have my DNA, if my body's tested, it'll have DNA from Reese's clothes on it.
Yes.
Despite the fact he had nothing to do with it. So that suddenly means that he might have to be questioned or involved or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So that's the extent to which forensics is advanced these days. It's so good now. You can recreate so much stuff.
So surely it's got to the point where it's so good. Now the list of suspects is way too big and makes this way harder. So it's defeated. It's sort of eaten itself.
It's sort of, like those detective closed room things. It's only like there's 5,000 people called to the room. You're probably all wondering why I got you.
It's obviously they've got good methods to winnow it down. And you'd probably be released without charge after a day or two, Reese. But
I don't know, I give off a vibe. Yeah. I got those sort of eyes.
I thought that,
The motive's there. You spent 2 hours with him now, so we'd all understand.
Yeah. I would be cool. I mean, I've got. I've read about how cat hair is like one of the main things, right? Like murderers who have cats get caught quite quickly because if any of you've got a cat, you know that you basically constantly have cat hair on you,
right?
And so everywhere you go, that you're molting like a cat, and cat hair is coming off.
But then,
and I have a ginger cat, so you know that's just the most visible one, basically. Yeah.
But do police now go around, if someone's murdered, are they now going around everyone's house testing not only other people in the house, but their cats as well? You'll get a knock on the door
Maybe that's a double match. You got you and your cat.
Right.
Yeah.
We're looking for a British short hair. Grey fur. Yeah.
Do you know you can catch people by different prints that aren't fingerprints, various other prints?
Tongue?
So, tongue prints, you could, because that's individual, although I'm not sure how many people lick the murder scene before leaving.
You said tongue. I thought I heard time, which time prints would be as well.
Time print.
Do you leave a time print?
Yeah, your mobile phone leaves a signal on the terminal.
Yeah,
that's a lot of modern detective work.
Is that a time print? Did he leave a time print?
Well, I thought that's what Reece said, and I was just trying to help.
It's cool. I like the sound of...
Yeah, and if you punch in and out like you would at a work factory for every murder, you've left sort of a time stamp of, you know, sometimes you have to check into a building for fire records. You know.
There's the comments book on the way out.
Died lovely. Really easy to kill.
He left
a
2-star review? That's terrible. That's a real crime. Crime against this lovely hotel.
None of this is what I said.
Prince.
Glove Prince. So, oh, and
yeah. Wow, what? That's the whole point of gloves,
yeah,
isn't it?
Brilliant.
In this context.
I know, right? First of all, you hugged Andy on the way in and you're wearing gloves. None of it's going to work, Reece. So, yeah, people can take glove prints. And because people think what you guys think, which is that wearing gloves, I'm safe, they leave a lot more. They're much more cavalier than they are with fingerprints. But now there are various police forces that have made databases of glove prints. So if they can match it to another glove print found at a different place, then they'll know that it's the same person.
Just fibres that come off the gloves?
Yeah, from the fibres that come off the glove and the pattern that the glove makes on, you know, it'll make an imprint. And
God,
even
so clever.
And it's even, it doesn't matter if it's the same brand of glove that I'm wearing compared to you, Andy, because I'll be doing different things with my glove to what you're doing with your glove, and so it'll wear in a different way.
Stop it.
Yeah.
It's nuts. It's absolutely nuts what can be done.
Yeah.
Ear prints. It's amazing. Someone was caught in France by their ear prints because they'd been listening up against the keyholes of lots of student halls doors. And
earprint. Oh my god.
Yeah. That's incredible.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That because footprint or shoe prints, I imagine, as well, would be a thing. You would see a size 12 Adidas, you might have certain muds and
that's
stuff that you can
stuff with all this.
But earprint, that's like eyebrow print or that's so neat.
Say you can get a bum print.
What do you mean get a bum? What if you sit on the photocopier?
Don't you have a bum print?
Yes.
I just wonder if that's ever been used. Sorry, everyone's
looking at me. Sorry, you mean if you're the murderer were to put their bare arse onto something at the scene, they could go, oh, we know whose bum that is.
Sorry, yeah, exactly.
It's a classic calling card with a lot of murderers.
Yeah, the police line up for those.
Yeah, turn around.
Amazing sight. Can bum number 2 move around now, please? Have you, this is a very cool thing, have you heard of forensic ecology?
Forensic ecology.
This is, I read an interview with a woman called Rosie Everett. She uses materials found in the natural world to solve crimes, right? So, specifically microfossils.
Oh.
There are these things called diatoms. We've spoken about them, I think, ages ago. Basically, they're microscopic single-cell algae, and she can use these, the presence of these, to come up with a profile of the soil in an area, which can then solve a crime. So, there's a castle in Cheshire called Beeston Castle, right? Which is a protected area. And there were some metal detectorists, nighthawks, dirt sharks, who'd gone and nicked Bronze Age artifacts from the soil around there. And when they're caught, they just say, oh, we found them somewhere else. Can't prove anything, you know, except for Rosie Everett, who came up with a profile of the soil based on the microscopic algae found there and proved... That's the soil they've been taken from.
Wow. Oh, looked at the objects and went, hey, this soil's the same.
Yeah, there was
as
a bit of soil,
soil
found on the Bronze Age artifacts they'd nicked from there, and there was a bit of soil around the castle. Like, just so.
Wasn't
clever.
One of the ways they caught Ian Huntley from nettle disturbance?
Really?
So,
really?
Nettles, he trampled nettles that meant that they were now growing outwards in a way they don't naturally, that sort of proved that he was there in the woods at that time or something.
Well, so it's next generation nettles still affected by the previous.
Yeah, it's like months later they had grown in a certain, like, because they would have been. And then they went outwards instead of up or something like that. They was like, yeah.
That's incredible.
That's mad. And slightly less, I'll just quickly tell you a slightly less technologically advanced one of this guy I read about who got caught doing a crime after he got the crime scene a lot of detail tattooed on his chest.
Oh, gosh.
So he literally, it was like, he'd like murdered someone outside a liquor store or something, and so he got the liquor store like a painting on his chest with him doing the murder.
Above it,
it says the name of his gang, which was Rivera. It said Rivera Kills above it, and it was like a revenge killing. And he had that on his chest. And one day, the police were just like flicking through a book of gang tattoos, apparently, and they were like, "Wait, that's that liquor store. We've been trying to figure out where that who killed that guy.
Oh,
that's that guy
God.
Killing that guy." And then he was just tried. And then
that's brilliant. Yeah. We've spoken about in the past how the Yakuza would be busted because they all have very individualistic tattoos, and if they're on the run, they might show up on Instagram, sort of like, you know, topless.
Yeah.
I mean, if you follow the accounts I do, and, and they'll be like, "Hey, that's him. That's the guy." Like tattoo spot. plotting is a big way of busting criminals.
Yeah.
Did you say your one, Andy, happened in Beeston?
Yeah.
Well, that was when we did our first book of the year. There was a crime there committed, which thousands of bees were stolen from Beeston.
Yeah.
I wonder if she can solve that crime now using this new technology.
Maybe.
I'd sort of Holland forgotten that, but as soon as you said we'd had it in our book, I thought it'll have been a story about bees, won't it? That's the level we operate
at. We put it on the back. It was our blurb. That was our leading fact. Okay, it is time for our final fact of the show, and that is Anna.
My fact this week is that parents of newborn penguins take thousands of naps per day. Absolute slackers.
Lazy.
Yeah. To be fair to them, they're taking very short naps. These are chinstrap penguins, so they live in the Antarctic and around the South Pacific. And there were scientists studying them recently on King George Island, and they found that they nap over 10,000 times a day, but they only nap for about 4 seconds at a time on average. But still, it gets them something. And I mean, they managed to tot up 11 hours of sleep a day.
That's insane.
Amazing. Which is basically blinking. Yeah. It's basically every time they blink, they do it for 4 seconds and fall asleep.
Yeah. Like when you fall asleep at the cinema or the theatre, you know, and you have that kind of...
Or a train that jolt.
Yeah. I've never left one of those occasions feeling noticeably rested.
No.
Despite doing that kind of semi-sleep.
But I wonder if you had 1,000 of them.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. You just haven't been to a long enough play.
You know how you get those sort of rise and grind influencers these days who are all about, you know, getting up at 5 a.m. doing a gratitude journal, you've got to like circadian rhythm and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. You know, you've got to get sunlight before coffee and all this. I mean, do you think if they read this pretty soon everyone would be like, no, don't go to bed. Just stand there.
Just
and
long
then
blink.
4 seconds at a time. And you just feel perfect. So you're never asleep.
Rejuvenated.
Hustle never sleeps.
Yeah. It'll become a thing. And they go into deep sleep, which I'm not sure we're very good at doing within 4 seconds, but they looked at their brainwaves.
Wow. Really?
Yeah, so it was quite
like a
difficult.
It's like a bungee jump into sleep and then back.
Yeah.
It just feels so rapid to get there.
Yeah, deep sleep.
But yeah, they go into
so cool.
slow wave sleep. They really rigged them up, these penguins. It's amazing they could sleep at all. There was this researcher, Wong Young Lee, who I think was leading the research, who said it was exhausting for them because they had to catch 14 penguins and they had to get equipment on their brains to measure their brain activity, and then they had to get accelerometers to see how fast to like record their muscle movements, see how fast their muscles are moving and their positions, and then they film like whether their heads start nodding. And
so is it possible that the penguins actually sleep completely normally, but when they're manipulated by scientists can't sleep at all?
I think so. They did say this is probably serving the purpose of meaning that they can guard their young, so it's when they guard their newborn children, because one parent will be off getting food, the other parent has to look after the kid, so you never sleep for so long that the kid can get in trouble. It's like having a baby monitor. They said it's probably because of that, but it could also be because, you know, penguins, when they're looking after their young, they hang out in these massive groups of just thousands of them, and it's really loud and busy. Like, these researchers said we couldn't sleep because it was just so hectic there, because so many penguins.
These researchers are complaining a lot about their own sleep, I have to say. For someone else, for a study about something else.
Four seconds, I wish. But they said it could just be that the penguins can't sleep for longer than that. They might be able to sleep for 8 hours in a row, but it's just that they've been woken up every 4 seconds because it's so noisy and bustling.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right.
Huh.
It is crazy. There are lots of animals in the world that do, when they've had a baby, are forced into a position of just being awake. Like dolphins, for example, are awake for like a full month. They just can't go to sleep because their baby dolphins can't sleep. So they're just awake the whole time. For a month. And they basically, they just have to be awake. And with them, part of the dolphin not being asleep as a baby is as they keep movement, they're building up blubber, they're building up all the things that they need to make them into a bigger dolphin. That's like, and then after like a month or so, they all start sleeping again. But the mum is just solidly awake.
But don't they do the half of their brains at a time thing?
So I'm not sure that's what I tried to find out, but I couldn't find anything that said they go to half asleep. Because yes, dolphins shut half their brain asleep.
Yeah.
As far as I could see, that wasn't part of any
of
the...
at all, not either half.
Yeah.
Blimey.
I
don't know about all bears, but don't polar bears do a similar thing where they basically just attach the children to them for the whole time, so the children don't really walk around following them. Like you see like elephants, you see them following and stuff like that, but polar bears is just like, you see a picture of a new mum in the polar bear community, there's just kids just like strapped.
Do they have what like kind of slings are they on. Using?
I think they, yeah, I don't have papoose. but they're just like grabbing hold of them and they just have to walk around with that and then just do everything from there until
that's
they
so
like
great.
Sit down again because
so
they just
cozy.
Don't walk.
Like tassels. It's got a lot of baby tassels. Yeah.
Elephant seals?
Yes.
Which is a huge, great, massive, big things. We got sent a fact actually by Victoria Piedadi, so thank you for that, Victoria, which is that sleeping elephant seals, they fall through the sea as they nap. They are mammals. They do not have gills. They they can last up to about half an hour underwater, but sometimes they will just nap. And it seems like they just spiral downwards through the water asleep.
Wow. That's absolutely terrifying.
That happens in my brain quite a lot when I'm trying to get to sleep. You know, when you jolt awake because you felt like you were falling.
Yeah.
Well, imagine if you woke up and you're in the bottom of the sea. Because it is fast. They drop 400 meters in 10 minutes, which, if you can, that's like we're talking the highest buildings in the world. That's like the full height of them almost.
Yeah.
And it takes quite a long time. Jesus. You know, if you go to one of those skyscrapers, the lift takes about that long.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're going that fast.
And if you wake up when you've only got 3 minutes of oxygen left, that's presumably quite stressful.
I would have thought so, yeah.
What's the protocol? What do they do?
You can't really do that dad thing of faking that you weren't asleep on the sofa during a Sunday afternoon movie. You know, dads will always be like, I wasn't asleep, I'm watching. I'm
resting my eyes.
Dad, you're at the bottom of the ocean.
Have you ever met a penguin?
Because
I've got another clang.
Here we go. Which of your winter sports were you taking part in with the Olympic team?
Well, I did do the skeleton, which is basically how penguins travel.
Oh, yes.
Did you?
They go, you know, it's like the head first one where you're just hurling through. Yeah,
that looks terrifying.
They train on just on a track. So just on wheels on a track rather than on ice.
Right.
And this is the context where, so there were penguins.
I did meet penguins, actually. This is just a bracketed
anecdote.
Because you mentioned the Winter Olympics, and that was penguin adjacent. I met a penguin in Australia, actually.
Okay, right.
I was a child. There are photos of it, but I'm trying to get my head around what it was, because from memory, it was like in our hotel, where the various pools were. There was different pools, but it was presented in a sort of like, go over to this section. It was like a quite kid-friendly hotel. It was like, this section is meant to be the Arctic or whatever. And then in between two of these pools on the walkway was just like this bit where these penguins were.
Right.
And they would do like feedings at a certain time every day and you could go and hang out. And then I was a penguin's my favorite animal. I was obsessed with penguins as a kid. Penguin is actually one of the many nicknames I tried to start for myself as a child.
Well, you can be honest. You were 23, weren't you?
That's a child in some communities. And then... like I got picked as the volunteer for this sort of penguin feeding, and I was like doing the whole, you know, I was chucking the fish.
Wow. Yeah,
and
then great.
Shook his fin.
Shook the penguin fin.
Arm.
What do they have?
Wing.
Wing. Shook his wing. Fin. Shook his fin. Yeah. Fuck off, mate. Shook his wing. Yeah.
That's lovely.
Oh. That's very cool.
And now your DNA is on that penguin, of course. And if it's murdered,
if that penguin goes missing, I'm absolutely fucked.
Yeah.
But my cat's also a suspect because there's definitely cat hair on that penguin now.
Have you seen the penguins at the zoo, the London Zoo?
No.
Oh, well, I recommend. That's probably the nearest penguin to us geographically. I don't think you can meet them as far as I'm aware. There was something about them, wasn't there, though? There was something. Isn't there enclosure? It's the only grade 2 listed.
Oh, yes. It's got that amazing... Penguin we've talked about it before.
Oh, it's in a Harry Styles video.
I think that rings a bell. That
enclosure that is grade 2 listed, with that spiral thing in the middle, is where the As It Was video is filmed. He's like stood on that thing and all these women are sort of circling.
Right.
Are they dressed as penguins?
They're wearing tuxedos.
I wonder what they did with the penguins when they were filming that video.
I know, right? I think a lot of people on the internet were wondering that as well. I mean, supposedly it's just a time when they weren't using it.
How can they not be using their main home and enclosure?
The album is called Harry's House, so it does feel like you marched in and went, this is Harry's House.
This is Harry's House.
Get out. Yeah.
Something that sleeps quite weirdly is spiders. And they actually are unique in the animal world, I think, in that they don't have the right body clock. And
right.
with all, they're the only things we know about that don't have the right body clock. So, you know, we're all on a basically 24-hour body clock, although sometimes when people go and live in caves, they sort of stretch to 25 hours or 23 or whatever. But mostly...
So that was such a dismissive roll of the air, like, this is a thing that's personally inconvenient to you on more than one occasion.
Those caving are always late.
Anna's waiting outside the cave at the table for two. Oh, God's sake.
Every time. Circadian rhythm, my ass.
Yeah.
So mostly, even bacteria operate on a 24-hour body clock, but spiders don't. And we don't really know why, except that they're fucked up. So they have the shortest body clocks ever known. Some spiders have been found to have 17-hour body clocks. But this should really mess with them because... So spiders left their own devices, and these are specifically trash line orb weavers, which sounds...
Slam.
Yeah.
I mean, roasted or what?
They're actually called that because they hide in their webs in a pile of crap. So they, like, will put dead bodies and feces and dirt in their web, and then they hide amongst it.
Wow.
It's not dissimilar to my room. So
and that's how you catch flies. Anyway, they need to wake up at night and get super, super active in the dark, and they spin their webs at nighttime, and they erect this big pile of trash to live in. Mm. And then in the daytime, spiders fall asleep still, which is why when you see them in daylight, they're usually just motionless. Huh. And then they go nuts at night in the dark. But it turns out if you subject a spider to full darkness, it starts waking up and weaving its web many hours before night would actually fall.
Mm.
So it wakes up like on the 17-hour mark rather than on the 24-hour mark. So that means they're constantly kind of jet lagged, right? Because they're constantly, their bodies are going, hey, we've got to wake up now. Mm. And then it's like, no, you've got to stay asleep because it's not night yet. And then night comes and then they have to go to sleep and they're wide awake. But they manage to just reset themselves every day.
Do they get cranky?
Well, maybe that's why they're such bastards. Mm. And they're always eating each other and hanging out in the corner of the room, deliberately scaring people.
Oh, I feel for them. That sounds very rough.
Doesn't it?
But apparently you can't catch up on sleep anyway, right? There's a myth, the whole idea of like, I only got 6 hours sleep last night, so I'm going to now have 10 hours sleep or whatever. It's a myth. You're better off just having 7 or 8 every time.
Huh.
So you it's impossible to catch up on sleep.
What? So you'll always be a bit more tired in life.
No, you just
keep.
Yeah, sorry, I don't mean it's impossible. God, in this economy, it's bloody impossible to catch up on sleep. I just mean that it actually makes it worse.
Really?
So it's like, it's not a tally for the week where you're trying to get. It's like, no, just every day try and get 7 or 8.
Yeah. I did not know
I've
that.
Never don't understood try that before, and improve it with the way you put 10. It. Because the way to avoid being underslept is then just to have 7 or 8 hours rather than.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because I assumed it was the other thing.
Me too.
And that. There's a ratchet and it only gets worse for your life.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. But it's not like there's a certain amount of hours you must sleep in your life. Yeah. And if you're not getting to the total, like you're filling it in like one of those thermometers in at school when you're trying to get donations.
Yeah. Well, you can actually trick yourself into thinking you've had more sleep, can't you? Remember we did that thing about the placebo sleep experiment that was done in America where they told people that they'd had more sleep than they actually had and they performed better in tasks.
I always use this as a life hack to try and tell myself every morning I've had loads of sleep if I haven't.
Do you?
It hasn't worked yet.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
You need someone else to tell you that in order for you to actually believe it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's work.
Because you know what
But how can you ever do that? Because, you know, if you're employing someone to do that, you would also
exactly.
know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like if your phone told you, I'd believe it.
Yeah, those apps, sleep apps, should
just
lie.
They should just lie.
Yeah. Yeah. Everyone would get so much more done.
Maybe they are lying. Because they wouldn't tell us, would they? Because that defeats the object. So perhaps that's what they're
I bet if you have it and you work for the app, it always tells you that you got loads of sleep.
Yeah.
So that you're more productive in the day. For everyone else, I think, do what you want. If they know from your phone that you work for a rival app.
Yeah, if you work for Samsung,
they just go, sorry, mate, that was terrible. You're knackered.
God, you look awful.
Okay, that's it. That is all of our facts. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in contact with any of us about the things that we've said over the course of this podcast, we can all be found on our various social media sites. I'm on Instagram on @Schreiberland. Andy?
On Twitter @AndrewHunterM.
Penguin?
At Penguin on all the forums and at Rhys Jamesy on Instagram.
Yep, or if you want to get through to us as a group, where can they go, Anna?
You can go to @nosuchthing on Twitter, or you can email podcast@qi.com.
Yep, or you can go to our website, which is nosuchthingasafish.com. All of our previous episodes are up there, as well as links to Club Fish and various other bits of merch. Do check it out. Otherwise, just come back again next week and we'll be here with another episode, and we'll see you then. Goodbye.